Hi, it's David Korn here, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief at Mother Jones. While Jamila King and the crew are out for a little summer break, I am grabbing the microphone to share with you a fascinating interview I did with one of the great cultural and literary figures of the past 50 years, the Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, Gary Trudeau. For five decades, Gary Trudeau has been writing what is one of the most important and most entertaining comic strips in American history, Doonesbury. He started the strip in October 1970 as a student at Yale. With its sharp-witted look at American politics and American life, it quickly became a phenomenon, eventually appearing in over 1,000 newspapers. He's lampooned every president of the last half century and has introduced scores of original and engaging characters. This includes a core group of college students and, eventually, their own kids. Members of Congress, a Viet Cong fighter, an obnoxious TV reporter named Roland Headley, a radical priest, an exiled authoritarian leader who ends up working as a strategist for Donald Trump, a VA counselor, a CIA operative named Havoc, Uncle Duke, that never-say-die con man, and so many others. Trudeau became the first comic strip artist to win a Pulitzer, and as the strip continued, he has worked on acclaimed television projects. After the first Gulf War in 1991, he became an advocate for wounded vets. In 2014, he ceased the daily strip, but his Sunday cartoons keep on coming. With Doonesbury, Trudeau has been an American Dostoevsky, producing a never-ending novel now stretching over 50 years. Gary Trudeau, welcome.
Thanks, David. Happy to be here.
Now, to celebrate and commemorate 50 years of Doonesbury, you've put out a collection that has every strip you've done. It's called Dbury at 50. It comes with a flash drive that contains over 15,000 strips and a user manual. How daunting was this project? And when you looked at the old stuff, can you remember even drawing those strips?
I can't. Unfortunately, I have an assistant who's been with me for almost the entire run, and we like to think of him as our institutional memory. His name's David Stanford. He's been my editor at Holt going back to the 70s. And so when we've put together these anthologies, he has always kind of taken the lead because he actually recalls what I've done. He's kept track of all the story arcs, and I sometimes run into trouble because I forget that a given two characters have already met and have already interacted in some way. And the readers are very quick to point that out, so David usually saves my bacon on that. We didn't want to make the mistake we'd made with the 40th anniversary collection, which was producing an enormous slab of a book that just wasn't very user-friendly. It weighed 10 pounds. It should have come with four screw-in legs. So we didn't want to do that again. So I came up with this idea of cramming it, the whole thing, the whole run, onto a little flash drive, which, of course, doesn't weigh more than an acorn. My original idea was to make it as striking as the Beatles' White Album, which, for those who weren't alive then, was an album the Beatles put out, and the cover was plain white, and it had a tiny embossed logo of the band just saying the Beatles. And that was it. And I thought this was a fantastic idea until I got the proofs back, and I went, well, wait a minute, this probably only works if you're the most famous band in the world and the entire planet is waiting for your next album to drop. The one thing we held on to is there are four portraits of the foundational characters in the back. And that was a kind of tip of the hat to the way the White Album showed the Beatles. There were four Richard Avedon photos in the back, and they're deeply in shadow. So that part we held on to. And this was a wonderful project for a pandemic. I mean, it took countless hours, and it was very immersive process pulling all this together. And, it gave me some way to feel useful during those months where we were all in self-storage.
I wonder if you were surprised looking back at any of the strips or storylines. And I also wonder if any of them stand out to you now, any that you're particularly proud of or that had an impact on the real world in a way that you didn't envision.
Well, it's rare that satire actually has an impact on the real world. I think maybe Tina Fey's portrayal of Sarah Palin actually did have an impact. But I think for the most part, those of us in comedy or satire don't really expect that to happen. During one of the primaries, I once had dinner with the great late columnist, Mary McGrory. And she started talking about how in her entire storied career, she didn't feel that any of her columns had actually ever changed anything. It actually had any kind of impact. And I started thinking about that. And that's really not a bar that most satirists try to clear. You know, we're there to entertain and maybe to have people think and judge events in certain ways, but we don't really expect a change to come of it. And the only occasion I could think of in which the strip had actually altered events was when I did a 2 or 3 weeks on the Palm Beach pass cards. At the time, Palm Beach had an ordinance that required employees to carry pass cards to get onto Palm Beach Island. It was a kind of apartheid-like ordinance that was enforced by the local police. Once I actually drew attention to it, it became an embarrassment for Palm Beach, and the state legislature decided that wasn't good for Florida's image. So they passed a bill, which was called the Doonesbury Bill, and the governor signed it, and he sent me the pen. And so, yeah, I have that one moment, but mostly satire is aspirational.
Well, 15,000 strips and one law passed in the state of Florida. That's not a bad record. Most of us don't get even one law anywhere. But one thing that I find notable is that, you know, you're famous for poking fun at presidents and doing so from a liberal perspective. But you've done a large number of strips and storylines about American GIs and veterans and the issues they face, PTSD, brain injuries, sexual assault, discrimination. Can you talk about how you got onto that path?
Sure. Back at the very beginning of the strip, one of the foundational characters, BD, I sent him off to Vietnam to get out of a term paper was his apparent reason. But once he got there, he got really into it. And he was taken prisoner by a character named Fred, a Viet Cong fighter, and they both get lost. And it was a hippie fantasy about how we could all get along if we just got to know each other as individual human beings. And it in no way corresponded to the GI reality. However, it did appear in Stars and Stripes. And the enlisted men kind of took to it, I think perhaps in part because it was clear evidence that somebody was thinking about them. And in subsequent years, I've had, veterans of the Vietnam era express gratitude for just the fact that I was writing about them, just that I was paying attention to what was going on to some degree. And it bought me enough goodwill so that when the first Gulf War came along, I started hearing from soldiers, and in particular, a commander of a fire base outside of Kuwait City, who invited me to come over and spend some time. He had been a young lieutenant in Vietnam, and he wanted to show me the difference between the conscripts that he had to wrangle in Vietnam and the professionalized army of the early 1990s. So he got me over there. I couldn't get over on my own. The Saudis wouldn't grant me a visa because I had been writing about how the Saudi young men were sitting out the war. And so he said, well, just come over. And so I did. And I arrived in the middle of the night. And as I'm getting closer and closer to immigration, I'm beginning to be concerned that, you know, here I am showing up in Saudi Arabia with no visa in the middle of a war. Just before I get to the customs agent, a side door opens, and two or three, they call them chocolate chips, the guys in the, you know, the GI uniforms, they swooped in, they grabbed me by my elbows and took me out the side door, stuffed me in a helicopter and flew me to Kuwait. So there was like no record of my ever having entered or left Kuwaiti airspace, Saudi airspace. And once I got there, I met with this tank commander, a guy named Bill Nash, who went on to lead NATO forces in the Balkans. And he said, here's the deal. We'll let you go wherever you want, but in the evenings, you got to go talk to my guys. And they're fresh off the battlefield. Your work might benefit from face-to-face encounters with people who have just who have just faced death and who have just been involved in combat. And so that's, you know, who wouldn't take that deal, right? I mean, you'd take it. So after the war was over, we entered into our next military engagement when Bush invaded Iraq. By that time, I'd made some friends in the military. And when BD is wounded in the Battle of Fallujah and he loses his limb, I immediately heard from the DOD and from the Pentagon. And they said, look, we see what you're doing. And it might be helpful to you if you come talk to some soldiers at Walter Reed on Ward 57, which is where the amputees were. What do you say? Now, the subtext of that was, I think they thought this might go a whole lot better if you got it right. And there's no way you can really understand what these folks are going through if you don't spend some real time with them. So I went and for the next several years, talked to not just the soldiers, but their caregivers. And then downstream to the mental health experts, the psychiatrists who were helping them deal with PTSD, none of which I could have really gotten my arms around without the help of the military.
So that's fascinating. You were a wartime cartoonist, right? I mean, there aren't many cartoonists. I don't know if Charles Schultz ever got out there on the battlefield.
Well, it's not exactly part of our portfolio, is it? I mean,
at one point
during the surge...
In Iraq, yes.
I arranged with a reporter from the Washington Post to fly over with him and stay at the Washington Post safe house. I spring my plans on my family just before Christmas, and my daughter burst into tears. And I thought, no, this isn't really my job. There are people who do this much better, and I can just read them. Yes, it would be great to have those firsthand experiences, but I don't need to put them through that. That's not what I do.
Well, I've always thought that the veteran storylines, which have been prevalent now for 30 years, just gave the strip a completely different dimension than others. You know, you still manage to, you know, make jokes and see the humor in it. But, it was very often very moving and very poignant. And I can just imagine it was a bit of a challenge to you to sort of figure out how to cover these things in a cartoon strip that people come to for humor.
Right, right, and that's part of the covenant with the reader, right? Is I've got to entertain you at the end of the day, but the stories were, you know, they were just so moving. The first room I walked into, there was a young woman. She was a graduate from Notre Dame, a beautiful young woman who was a basketball star, and she joined the Army and was a sergeant in the MP, and the women were supposedly not being sent into combat at that time, but she was assigned to guard a police station outside of Baghdad. And she was told to go up on the roof of the police station where there were sandbags all arrayed as a defensive posture. And she got down behind the sandbags and she had no sooner settled in than an RPG flew over her shoulder and blew up the wall behind her. So she went into battle mode. Her training kicked in. She flicked off the safety. And the first thing you do is return fire because you want your opponent to be just as scared as you are. So she threw her arms over the sandbags to return fire. And another RPG came in and ripped through her arm, took off her forearm and her front hand and covered her in sand as they blew up all the sandbags. So her team came up and grabbed her off the roof, took her down, and put her on the hood of a Humvee, and the medic started tying off her arm. And then her sergeant, her platoon sergeant, went back up on the roof against orders and dug through the sand and found her hand and removed her wedding ring and came back down and placed it in her remaining good hand. And she said, he didn't have to do that. I could get another ring, but it meant the world to me. You know, I was just blown away. This is my first story, the story of soldier love and what these guys do for each other, how that kind of care that and bonding that soldiers feel. I'd read about it, but You know, somebody once asked, I guess it was Sebastian Younger, the author, asked a soldier, what is a hero? And the soldier said, nobody knows. None of these Medal of Honor winners think of themselves as heroes. And they said, why not? Why isn't what they did heroic? And they said, look at it this way. If you're a mother or a father, you're walking down the street with your child and the child runs into traffic, what do? You don't think about it. You run into the street to save that child. He says, that's the way we think of each other. And some of these guys don't even like each other, but they will lay down their lives for their brothers. And it's a very profound thing. So I tried to get at that, you know, as I say, that was the first story I heard when I walked into Walter Reed. I'm the son of a doctor, and what good diagnosticians do is they listen. They listen to stories. And if I inherited anything from my father, it was a willingness to and a fascination with story and to listen to story and to see what meaning I can find from story and how I can turn that into art.
We'll be right back with more with Gary Trudeau right after this.
Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give.
Let's get back to my conversation with Gary Trudeau. Now, one of the recurring characters in the strip is a man named Donald Trump. You introduced him into Doonesbury in 1987. Now, you tend not to draw presidents and prominent people within the strip. You show like the White House exterior, and you have dialogue from, say, Richard Nixon emerging from inside the building. When it came to George W. Bush, I remember you depicted him as a floating cowboy hat. But with Trump, you actually portrayed him. You drew him out. So I wanted to know, why did you draw him? And why did you first make him a character? Did you know something in 1987 that the rest of us didn't?
No, I just knew that he was a kind of right out of the box cartoon character as a personality, as a person. And I thought it'd be much more fun having him and Duke interact, and the other characters interact, if he in fact joined the cast. And he was fun to draw and became even more fun as the years went by, and he took on this kind of Baroque appearance. You know, it was just too irresistible. So I had to bend my own rules. I had to just say, okay, it's an anomaly. I haven't done this in the past. It's a kind of aesthetic contradiction for me to introduce it, because I have elected not to actually draw political figures up until now. But it would have been cartoon malpractice not to actually have a go at him and to do it every day. I write about many other things as well. And so when I come back to him, it was always fun. I didn't look at my old drawings. I would just say, okay, I'm going to reimagine him again today. You know, and as his face started melting and collapsing and getting oranger and weirder, it just became more and more fun.
Now, I saw a newspaper clip from the 1980s that quotes Trump complaining about you. He said, quote, "There are 210 million people in this country. Why does he have to keep putting me in his comic strip month after month? Actually, I don't read his stuff, you know? I did well in school, but for the life of me, I still can't understand what Doonesbury is all about." There was this bit of a feud between the two of you. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it's always good for business. And George Herbert Walker Bush never quite understood that. And he attacked me with as much regularity as Trump. His son, however, it was in the manual that you know, 43 put together about 41 that said things not to do that dad did, or things to do that, you know, that dad didn't follow through on. So one of them was, don't even acknowledge the press. Say nobody's name. Don't give them, you know, don't dignify them. Don't elevate them by mentioning them. And with only one exception that I can think of, Bush never mentioned Reporter by name. Or any of his critics. They did not exist. It was a very smart thing to do. It was a very disciplined, smart thing to do. The more Trump actually complains about me, obviously, the better for me, the better for business. And we always slapped the insults on the covers of the book as blurbs.
Now, was it harder or easier to work with the Trump character when he became president? And I will note that in April 2016, before he became president, you wrote, some people feel that Trump is beyond satire, but we professionals know that he is satire. So at that point, when you wrote that, he still was not yet president. Well, most people thought he wouldn't be. Becoming president, what did that mean to you?
It really changed the business model. It became a themed strip. And that had only happened once before, and that was with the Gulf War. Once Bush moved all those troops over to Saudi Arabia, there were 500,000 at the height of the buildup. I thought, okay, this touches on every aspect of American life. And indeed, either, you know, directly or indirectly on the lives of all the characters that I would normally be writing about. So I thought to myself, I will simply write about this war until its conclusion. And I did that. When Trump became president, I thought, okay, this is my project, because I did notice early that he had become subtext for everything, that there was no conversation that sooner or later did not circle back to Trump, no matter what the topic was. That, in a way, that was kind of liberating, because you know, I didn't have to tear myself away from what everybody was thinking and talking about simply to kind of marginally serve the interests of pushing the stories forward for all the other characters. So if the strips weren't directly about Trump, they were about how Trumpism was landing in the lives of all my characters.
Looking back, do you think your strip was something of a rallying cry, or maybe a safe space for those Americans who looked at what was happening in the world, Watergate, Vietnam, the Iraq War, the Trump presidency, and were worried or scared about the absurdity of it all and wondered what the hell was going on? Did you provide a refuge for those of us who were afflicted by the news?
Well, I think you've said it exactly right in your choice of the word afflicted, because the mission statement for satire is to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted. And that's always been the case. And, you know, which is why most satire punches up. It's no fun punching down. It's no fun for anyone, which is why there's so few conservative comedians. Yeah, I think that, you know, to give you the most dramatic example of how that works, after 9/11, all the comedy shows went off the air. And I, in fact, suspended the strip for a week, not because I didn't think I could do the strip, but because what we had sent out was just didn't make any sense. It was so beside the point that we just killed it. And I waited a couple weeks before I kind of figured out how to get myself back in. It kind of leached all the meaning out of everyday life and out of, you know, everybody's everyday jobs. But over time, what you realize is that civilization, society, only works if all the bit players are pulling together. And that includes the storytellers. That includes the entertainers. They were key players in front of the campfire with our ancestors. Ever since 9/11, I haven't been skeptical about the usefulness of satire, I think, the way I was before. I do think it plays the kind of role you were alluding to.
Let me ask you a bit of a related question, and that's, what makes something funny? In your most recent book, you quote Mark Twain, who said, "The secret source of humor itself is not joy, but sorrow." huh, that's pretty heady. But, you know, what makes something humorous and amusing, and what makes people laugh?
I have no idea. It's you know, I don't write jokes. It's a little easier to try to understand the mechanics of humor when you look at a joke, because it, you know, has a setup and it has misdirection, and then it has, you know, this spring of surprise at the end. And E.B. White once said it's like dissecting a frog. You can do it, but it tends to die in the process. My own process is that I marinate in some subject that I'm interested in or some theme that I'm trying to develop. I'll do a lot of reading. I'll write around it and sort of circle it with, you know, try to find ways in. And then I'll walk away from it. And often it's like the elves who put together the shoemaker's pieces at night. In the morning, their shoes made, and I'll step into the shower and those connections are made. The different parts of the brain will talk to one another. And, you know, surprise is the essence of most humor. You don't see it coming. The humor that I admired growing up came out of movies like MASH. There are no jokes in MASH. It's just, I mean, there are lines that are funny, but there's no setup and waiting for the punchline to come. There are no gags in nature. That's not the way we talk. And I wanted to more faithfully reproduce the way that humans actually talk.
You and the rest of us have lived with the characters of the Doonesbury family for decades. Do you feel any desire to wrap up their stories at some point? I mean, all good novels and soap operas do eventually come to an end, don't they?
No, I feel like every time a strip goes out, we're dipping into some ongoing drama. And then when I'm not doing it, we pull out of it. People will ask me, well, what happened to this character? What did they do over the last 2 years? If I didn't write it, nothing happened to them. Unless I tell you something happened, it didn't happen. So I feel like it's just this narrative river that's just rushing along. And every now and then I pluck something up and I show it to you. And I, you know, maybe there'll be some strip that has some sense of finality to it. But I think it's more likely that I'll just stop. You know, I just won't write it anymore. And unlike a lot of the traditional legacy strips, I don't really feel inclined to hand it off to anybody. I feel like it's been a kind of personal journal in a way, and that you know, if somebody wants to write about the zeitgeist in this kind of way, that this particular way that I have, that they should you know, create their own damn strip. So, when I finally do tire of it, or when the audience tires of it, or whether newspapers go away, I'll just stop.
Well, I hope the river keeps on flowing for some more years. We've been talking to Gary Trudeau, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Doonesbury comic strip that is now celebrating its 50th anniversary. You can check out the strip at gocomics.com/Doonesbury and look for the 50th anniversary collection of every Doonesbury strip, which is called D-Bury at 50. That's that little fancy at sign. Gary Trudeau, thanks for spending time with us.
Oh, it's great fun, David.
I'm David Korn for the Mother Jones Podcast. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you, who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.
From PRX.